you want to do the intro, Seth?
Sure. You are listening to The Partially Examined Life, a podcast about philosophy by three guys who were once set on doing it professionally, but then thought better of it. I'm Seth Paskin, authentically experiencing myself as myself in Austin, Texas.
This is Mark Linton-Meyer, ontically but not ontologically in Madison, Wisconsin.
And this is Wes Allwun, and I didn't prepare anything clever in Boston, Massachusetts.
The question for episode 32 is what?
What is the meaning of being?
Sweet.
How do we ask the question of the meaning of being? Why have we forgotten the question of the meaning of being?
And whom are we reading?
We are reading Martin Heidegger's Being and Time, or at least a very small portion of it.
That would be the introduction and chapters 1 and 2. And did you guys get through 3?
No, just 1 and 2.
At least 1 and 2. And I cheated by listening to a good chunk of the Hubert Dreyfus Fall 2007 lectures that are available in a podcast form. And in fact, you can listen to them at double speed. They're great. He's like the dude. Since I was raised on my main continental prof in undergrad, Fritjof Bergmann, hated Heidegger, had no use for Heidegger at all. And so my education went straight from Hegel and Husserl to Sartre and was just taught that, yeah, Heidegger had nothing to add at all. So that I was very good to hear Hubert Dreyfus, who is like one of the preeminent Heidegger guys in the country, just really being a big Heidegger advocate and saying, oh, he's the most important philosopher, continental philosopher, at least, of the 20th century, that, you know, when Husserl is long forgotten, he's going to be there. He's the key dude who made the big discoveries.
Yes.
He discovered being.
I didn't realize those lectures were from 2007, as recently as 2007.
Yes. His book, Being in the World, I have right here a commentary, is from the 80s or something. Sixth printing was 1995. I don't know when the first printing was. Anyway, but he talks about how, oh yeah, I got that wrong in my commentary and I got that wrong. And that was, he's learned a lot. And even just during the lectures, he's reconsidering things, points of interpretation. It's pretty cool.
Even when we were in school, Dreyfus was one of the only American philosophers who was actively working on Heidegger, and certainly the most famous. We didn't get any Heidegger at UT, which is why I ended up writing my master's with a guy from the architecture department. There's nobody in the department.
We had some in the intro continental course. I had my hardcover of Being in Time from that course.
The McCarrion-Robertson translation? The black cover with just the white lettering? Yeah.
Dreyfus says that that is the only one. There's a new one that's coming out. It'll be better. But this is the only one to get even an approximation of what's going on. It was extremely useful because Heidegger throws around just as much undefined terminology as Husserl did. But yet the translators are very good at telling you, say, the difference between ontic and ontological.
I don't know if I want to already start this discussion, but
I'm just giving an example. I'm not telling the people what they mean.
Yes. Well, I don't think he throws it around the way Husserl did in Cartesian Meditations.
Yeah, I think he is clearer than Husserl, I think.
He definitely takes a long time to say anything, just like Husserl does. He's extremely methodical and giving the Greek and the Latin.
Yeah, I think he's probably clear to me because since I had all that ancient Greek and was indoctrinated in the Heideggerian cult that is St. John's. So I worshipped being for many years.
Good for you.
And I was also pleased to hear about some of the lecture series that have been published by Heidegger from around the same time as Being in Time, that he has several books that are just notes of his lectures. And one of the that we were considering reading this time was The Basic Problems of Phenomenology that came out right after Being in Time. I read some of that. I read the beginning of that, and it talks about some of the same issues, but in a much more straightforward way aimed at his students as opposed to aimed at posterity. You know, it still moves very slowly and is very meticulous, but it just approaches things from some different points of view. There's another one, Introduction to Metaphysics. That's a pretty famous lecture series that's from 37 or something like that, about 10 years after Being in Time, that it also goes over some of the same concepts, certainly. Yeah, just even looking at those made me think, okay, Heidegger is not the most difficult writer that I've ever read, which is one of the things that you might think just looking at Being in Time. I found it fully as difficult as the Cartesian Meditations and Hegel's Phenomenology or any of the other notorious toughies. Which doesn't mean I didn't unravel all the layers of that onion, man.
Well, that's good to know. I went looking through my old notebooks to find my notes. So for the listeners who don't know, Heidegger is supposed to be my bailiwick. And like I said, I wrote my master's thesis on Heidegger, not on Being in Time. But I studied in Germany specifically to work on Heidegger and to work at the university where his archives were, and Husserl's archives for that matter. And I studied with the only living student of his who was teaching, this guy called Professor Dr. von Hermann.
Oh.
So that was why I went over there, and that's what I did when I was over there. In theory, I guess I'm the authority on this, but I went through my old notebooks to find my notes on Being in Time and realized that they were all in German, that I had done. All my notebooks were in German. And in addition to my handwriting being such that I had a very hard time understanding what I had written, I realized that I was not even going to try to attempt to read my own thoughts in my graduate school German that I was learning at the time. At the time I was there, von Hermann was talking about some of Heidegger's later stuff, like about Hölderlin and Rilke, poets.
So he's writing about poetry. I knew he wrote a lot about art.
He wrote a lot about poetry, yeah. Later on in his life. Well, why don't I go ahead and give like a little quick sketch.
Unless I can jump in with a bit of news before actually get to the content here. Very important to our audience. Last night, Josh Casey, the guy who is one of my many brothers-in-law, who put up our WordPress page to start us off, broke the world record for whoopee cushions. I shit you not.
What does that mean?
It means that they have very precise requirements that you have to have a whole bunch of chairs and there's a set distance that they have to be apart. And then you put a whoopee cushion on each one. And how many can you sit on in 30 seconds? I believe it was 30 seconds. And he broke the record. The record was 27 before and he got 31. And he could have done more, but he was only set up for that. It was part of this big juggling festival thing. And they had an official, it was very official.
So he's in the Guinness.
He will be in the Guinness Book of World Records, yes.
Wow. You are related to greatness.
And apparently, even if you listeners say, I could do more than that right now, there's all this, like, to do anything with Guinness, there's all this red tape you have to get through. Like, it took like a year for him to set up this official trial thing. So you can't just do it in your house. And each whoopee cushion must make the whoopee cushion sound. If you sit on them too fast and they don't make the sound, it doesn't count.
Mm.
So, relate that to the mode of being of...
Well, he wasn't just getting the sound out of them. He was letting them reveal the sound that was within. And
he's letting them reveal themselves as they are in themselves. Well, congratulations to Josh.
Yes, congrats, Josh.
Okay. There are plenty of places on the web that you can go and get kind of a detailed biography of Heidegger, but I want to kind of call out a few highlights just to put some context so that you'll be able to understand some of the things when people talk about early and late Heidegger and the fact that he joined the Nazi party and what that means and why that got so many people upset and so on. So Heidegger was born in a very small town in southern Germany just before tail end of the 19th century. And he always lived in and around southern Germany in the small town. He was very, very provincial. And that's important because it influences the way he talks and thinks about things. He never lived in a big city, never wanted to go to a big city, never wanted to teach at a big university. And so throughout all of his work, you will see him using examples and metaphors and so forth that are all taken from pastoral, rural life. So there's a lot of people who have called him provincial and naive in that respect, but that just speaks to kind of where he's from and what he did. He was a very bright student.
Well, and he liked to talk to the peasants, says Dreyfus. Philosophers are, you know, academics and rich people in general are too infected by culture to sort of have pure experience or something like that. So being able to chat with the peasants regularly was a a specific reason why he wouldn't move to Berlin or something. This is a Hubert Dreyfus story anyway.
Yeah, well, Dreyfus traveled over there and met him while he was still alive, so he may have some anecdotes. But there's no doubt that the person who works the land is kind of his model to some extent for what constitutes authentic existence, and he never wanted to lose touch with that. And when we see what that means in the context of being in time, it'll make more sense, but it'll also make sense that only somebody who came from a background like that would ever write a book that talked about this stuff in this way. So he was a bright student, obviously. He was born Catholic, but married a Protestant woman. And there's a lot of people that make a lot out of his, he studied at one point for the priesthood, but decided against it. So people will read all different kinds of religious things into his work. Again, background, it's not super necessary. He was a student of Husserl's, and in fact, studied with Husserl, and then went to another university where he taught for a while. And when Husserl retired, Husserl was at the University of Freiburg, Heidegger came back and took his chair in philosophy at the University of Freiburg. During the time that he was there was the time of the rise of National Socialism, and he was elected by the other faculty members to be the rector of the university, which is essentially the representative of the university to the broader social world. And he joined the Nazi Party, and there are a number of, some more well-documented than others, issues, including some poor treatment of Husserl and some things that he wrote talking about National Socialism that made it very difficult for a lot of people to understand why he would be affiliated with that and also use it to discredit his philosophical thinking. While the Nazis were still in party, he resigned. He didn't resign from the party, but he resigned as rector and actually went into exile. They eventually decided that he was not ideologically suited, compatible with their ideology, and he ended the war in a work camp, digging ditches, I mean, and then basically was banned by the Allied powers after the war from teaching for about 3 or 4 years. Basically, that whole experience changed his way of thinking, and in the latter half of his life, instead of writing a sort of systematic philosophy like you see him being in time, he wrote more shorter essays, taught a lot, and focused more on what Mark was saying about poetry, art. He went back and wrote more about the Greeks. And the difference between the earlier Heidegger and the later Heidegger is sometimes called the turn, dikera. I think in general, you can say he never really changed what he was trying to accomplish, which was this obsession he had with talking about the meaning of being. But he realized that the program that being in time represented really wasn't something that could be accomplished. And just a couple things about that. Being in Time was intended to be a much bigger book than it actually is. There were several sections with multiple subsections, and he had not completed the book, but he was sort of forced to publish what he had written in order to get tenure and become a full-fledged professor because he hadn't been publishing anything. He'd just been teaching. What the turn represents is kind of this idea that he realized that the exercise that he was undertaking or the project of being in time wasn't really something that could be accomplished. Now, what's interesting is that Heidegger was an amazingly arrogant person. You can look at the anecdotes and whatever, but he never took responsibility. He never said he made mistakes. He never took accountability for anything that he did. And even when he talks about being in time, he uses this, he said something like, it was realized that the thinking was not up to the task of, you know, it's some very, very passive construction for why being in time couldn't be completed.
Mistakes were made.
Mistakes were made, exactly. And this is one of the things that really frustrated people, particularly his students like Hannah Arendt, who was a real devotee of Heidegger and obviously somebody who was super smart and very well-versed in what happened during the war.
And who he had an affair with.
You know, I don't know how that is stated as a fact, and it's not entirely clear to me. I think there's some biography out there that claims that there's fact proof for it, but nobody could ever say that they did have an affair.
Well, if it's in Wikipedia, it must be true.
Yeah, but she even pleaded with him to at least renounce what he did, and he refused. I mean, he's kind of a prick. And there's some cool stuff out on YouTube. You can find some, like a television interview with him, and you can see him speak. And even with the subtitles, you realize that he's just completely out of touch. for somebody who supposedly liked to hang out with peasants, he talks like he's from another planet. And nobody watching that who was at all a normal person or a normal German would understand what he was talking about.
It's Bob Dylan.
That being said, being in time in German, the way he uses language, it's very innovative and it's new and it's challenging, but it is a lot easier to keep things straight. Not easier to understand what's being said, but it's easier to keep things straight than it is in translation. So all these problems that the translators have keeping things straight, a lot of that stuff is much more clear in German just because of the way the words are constructed. And he says, you know, I'm going to use this word to mean this.
Right, because they're tinker toy words, right? Because it's like sorgen and besorgen, and those are, that's care and concern. You can see that they're just about the same in German, and that would mean something to the German speaker. Whereas for us, those are artificial terms.
Yes, just for the record, Dasein, for example, is a word that's very common in German that he uses in a kind of weird and twisted way and tries to tease out all this meaning. But being in the world is not a common phrase. And the construction in German looks weird in German, but at least you know what he's talking about. At least you can differentiate it because it's a big hyphenated clause, in der Welt sein. So for listeners who go out and look him up on the web, you're going to see all kinds of crazy stuff about. There was a lot of controversy in the 60s and 70s. He was very influential to particularly French philosophy, but there was a lot of hostility towards him. So basically what you have is somebody who is very, very smart, very, very well educated, trying to tackle an extremely difficult subject, but at the same time with a very, very, very limited worldview that he generalized and attempted to claim, and somebody who was extremely naive politically and socially. But I think still one of the more profound thinkers, and you'll see when we talk in a little bit about what the project of Being in Time is and what he tries to accomplish, why it spoke to me so personally. This was the book that changed my life philosophically. He was the thinker that changed my life philosophically.
And was it chapters 1 and 2 that changed your life philosophically? Will we get to see the change?
Yes. Yes, you will.
Okay. So the whole beginning part is, here's his methodology. Here's why we should talk about being and things like that. But the whole second half of the book is more what was really the foundations of existentialism, right? Is what counts as an ethics for him, of being an authentic person and just talking about your ways of being, having to do with your way of orienting yourself in the world in the way that Sartre or somebody like that would talk about it.
Yes, but as a qualifier, I don't think anybody would tell you that that counts as an ethics for Heidegger. In fact, that's a huge problem, that he never articulated anything with kind of a positive value system like that. So let me set the stage for what I think he's trying to do here and what he thinks the problem is. We have the history of philosophy that's spending all of this time trying to figure out metaphysics. And metaphysics, he says, is really the study of beings. His concern is to say, look, we're doing metaphysics, we're talking about, you know, what is a person? What is an object? What is an idea? What is God? And we haven't stopped to ask ourselves the question of what is the meaning of being. And you can kind of boil that down to this. When we say what is, we have an implicit understanding of the word is. And we never really fully articulate what that is, but we use it all the time. So when we say, well, what is the subject? Or what is an idea? Or what is God? What we really should be asking is, what is? What do we mean when we say is? And he says, we presuppose something by that. We have a sort of what you might call pre-ontological or pre-theoretical understanding, but we never really fully articulate it. And what happens is we then end up perverting or making assumptions about the other part of the question when we make theoretical assertions like the subject is this, or, you know, God is that. And so he said, through the history of philosophy, you have in Plato, it's the idea. In the medieval philosophy, it's substance or substantia. In modern philosophy, it's the subject or objectivity. And in Nietzsche, it's the will to power. Basically, all of those things are a stand-in for us.
Why are you saying they're a stand-in for us?
They're a stand-in because if somebody says, well, what is being with a capital B? Mm-hmm. And you say, oh, well, it's substance. And he's saying, well, substance is one way in which that we think of beings. That's the being of beings, but that's not being with a capital B. That's the being of certain beings. So in other words, he's trying to say, if you want to talk abstractly about being, not the being of an entity, but being in itself or being abstract, we haven't done that. So we just use the being of something as a stand-in for it.
And what's the problem with just saying it's just basic and indefinable? The fact that we use it all the time, you know, there's really no more to say about it. It's just is identity. It's the highest genus. Schopenhauer just gave us a version of this. If we want to talk about distinct for Schopenhauer realms, his interpretation of the fourfold root of the principle of sufficient reason, so we could talk about what kind of existence objects have in our experience, or we could talk about what kind of existence the paralogisms of logic have, but there's no reason to think that the fact that we use the word is for both of them, that they have anything in common. It's a completely empty, abstract concept to shove everything into.
So I think Heidegger would say there's a couple things wrong with that. The first thing is that to just say that it's empty is saying something about it. So since it's there and we feel the need to say something about it and we have some sort of quasi pre-theoretical understanding, we ought to investigate it. I think the other part of it is that he thinks the fact that we haven't done this, by not thinking through this properly, we've got ourselves caught in the modern metaphysics of objectivity. Descartes sort of derailed Western thinking, according to Heidegger, for hundreds and hundreds of years because he didn't ask the question of what the meaning of being was. He took this medieval conception and kind of twisted it around a little bit. And so what you end up with, and I alluded to this when we talked about Husserl, is you end up with people who are taking this metaphysics of subjectivity or objectivity and trying to torture the world out of it. By not asking the right questions, by not actually looking at what the meaning of being is, we've put ourselves in a situation where we're falsely set up this dichotomy between this transcendental subjective self and the so-called objective real world. And then philosophy spent 100 years spinning its wheels trying to figure out how to bridge the gap between the two. When in fact, if we had done what we should have been doing all along, we'd have realized there was no gap. And that, in short, is why this book was so important to me, is because I never was happy with or felt comfortable with, we need to prove the existence of the external world and prove that this is really the thing I'm really looking at, is really it in itself, and the thing in itself versus the appearance or the phenomena and so on and so forth. And I always thought, this is just ridiculous. I mean, how can you doubt the existence of the world? That doesn't even make sense. Putting yourself in that position just seems ludicrous to me. And Heidegger gave me a way to think about that. And that's why this was so important to me.
Since you've thrown that out, I think maybe, even though this is not chronologically where the book goes, maybe we should briefly discuss the epistemological jump here, because we had something like it in Husserl. Even though if you listen to Dreyfus, for one, he thinks that Husserl has all the same problems that Descartes and Kant did, this subjective-objective distinction and trying to get beyond the sphere of my transcendental subjectivity. And certainly Husserl talks that way, but in at least my analysis of it last time was that I thought he had a lot of the same insights in that work, at least, which came out after Being in Time did, but that you see in Being in Time that perception is not a matter of, like Schopenhauer talks about, that our inner sense is focusing on this sort of stream of data that has been fed in from the outer sense, that that's all just, according to Heidegger, is a theory that doesn't pay attention to the phenomena at all. And I think Husserl agrees with that, that you have to pay attention to what experience is actually like. And for both of these guys, a perception, for instance, actually gets a hold of the thing in the world there. It is transcendent in itself. It's not a matter of us being aware of the contents of our consciousness and those relate somehow to something outside. We are aware of the outside, and that's just primordial. So it seems like that was something that comes out of just phenomenology. That's not specifically Heidegger. Not that we have to dwell on that particular issue for the whole podcast.
I think that's a fair point. And obviously, Heidegger dedicated Being in Time to Husserl, and he studied with him, and he was very influenced by at least the Husserl that we didn't read. I don't think he had a very high opinion of the later work, the Cartesian Meditations. If you think about the difference between the two, they both want to take the givenness of the world, and that taking the world as given is the starting point for doing philosophy. I think they diverge at that point in that Husserl wants to use phenomenology or his phenomenological approach as a way to do some kind of a scientific-like discovery of first principles, founding of the sciences, you know, so on. And his process is to define something, what he calls the transcendental subject, which then is able to partake in the epoche and start to do the work, so to speak, of looking at the phenomena as contents of consciousness. And you have that whole intentional structure and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, folks are going to have to just listen to the previous episode. We're not going to re-explain the epoche in any length here.
Yes, I'll just say this. What Husserl does from the phenomena, the steps he takes, which are to say, the phenomena are contents of my consciousness and I can examine them in a certain way in order to be able to learn things and start, you know, uncovering the structure of experience. Mm-hmm. Heidegger's response to that is, as soon as you use the word consciousness, as soon as you call them contents or objects, as soon as you assume this intentional structure of you as the subject and them as objects of your consciousness, you have basically made the same mistake as Descartes. And that is why it's really torturous in the first part of Being in Time, where he's trying to say, I want to take the phenomena, but I want to let the phenomena to tell me what the being of the thing that is experiencing this phenomena, so to speak, is. So don't assume the subject. Don't assume that you're any type of thing. What does the phenomena tell you? And he says, obviously, because we're starting from our own point, we're starting in our own body or starting in our own place in the world and all that, we can't escape that. So the only way for us to get started is to kind of interrogate ourselves and look at what it is that we, meaning human beings, and the word he uses in the book is Dasein. What is the being of Dasein? That's the place we're going to start. We're not going to assume that Dasein is a subject and that the world is this set of phenomenal experience, so to speak. We're just going to ask ourselves, what in the world is Dasein, that being? And one of the first things he says is, it's not substance. That's not what the phenomena tell us.
I gotta say, it wasn't hard for me to figure out what points he was trying to make in this respect in here, but it was not always clear what his argument for them. I mean, with phenomenology, it's always going to be a matter of observation, careful observation. But in a certain ways, that makes you think, oh, I don't have to give an argument. I'm just giving careful observations. But of course, if you want other people to observe the same thing that you do, I mean, Husserl says, okay, stop right now. Stop imposing a theory on what you're seeing right now. Don't say, I'm seeing an object in the external world. Just describe the perceptions themselves and the fact that they point at other perceptions. They have certain structure, certain horizon to it. There's a certain structure of your experience. Let's just call it the transcendental ego, you know, the thing that seems to connect together all these different experiences. That is repeatable. That's the appeal of phenomenology. It's experimentation without having to get out of your chair. But Heidegger seems to have a very different idea of even what the phenomena are and how you go about examining them. It's certainly not just restricted to the here and now. In fact, that's the big mistake, right, that Husserl makes, that we need to analyze Dasein, analyze the human being along the horizon of time, whatever that ends up meaning.
Right. One way we could think about this, or one way we could talk about it, is that Heidegger would say that the approach that Husserl takes, that in itself, that act, what we might call inquiry or the attempt to know, is just one way that we as Dasein, as human beings, exist in the world. And there's no value judgment. It's not good or bad, but it certainly isn't the most fundamental. You can't do that exercise on the phenomena without having first some other kind of relationship in place. It's not as though you start with the bracketing or you start with the raw phenomena. You already have a world that's given to you, and it's given to you in a way that's much more direct and what you might call, again, pre-theoretical. I'm just going to use that term for the time being. So the famous example in the book, and I'll try to use this to explain this point, and we'll see if it works or not, is he talks about hammering. If you're using a hammer and you're hammering a nail, you are not thinking of the hammer or using the hammer or looking at the hammer as an object for inquiry, where you're trying to identify its properties or its traits, and you don't take your experience in using the hammer and try to break it into its constituent parts and talk about what those might be. you just use the hammer. You just hammer nails, and you're doing it for a purpose. Specifically, you're trying to build something. Let's say you're trying to build a chair. So your activity has a purpose, a towards which, and you are in no way, shape, or form theoretically or abstractly removed from that experience. Now, what you can do is you can stop for a second and you can look at the hammer as an object and you can separate yourself from it and turn it into some kind of field for visual experience. And when you get to the point where you're just focused on your perception and you're trying to do the sorts of thing that Husserl was talking about or make any kind of proposition like the cat is on the mat or something like that, you are doing something that is an essential human activity, but you are already way abstracted from something that you had to A, presuppose, that had to already be there for you to take that stance, and B, that is more, I hate to use the word primordial, but maybe more primary. Your being in the world, your existing amongst things and using things and functioning in the world is prior to your stepping back and viewing things and trying to comprehend them or know them or categorize them or classify them. And to him, that was one of the fundamental things that you discover when you think about what's the being of Dasein. Well, part of the being of Dasein is being in the world, and part of being in the world is using stuff and doing things. And all of that is prior to any kind of theoretical stance of knowing or apprehending or anything like that.
Do you think there's really a fundamental problem to the Cartesian enterprise given by Heidegger here? I don't think there's a problem by saying, oh yeah, there's all this stuff that's happening before you reflect, but now I'm reflecting on it. And in fact, hey, isn't Heidegger, didn't you just reflect on it to figure out what you're talking about right now? I mean, if anything, you could say Husserl's epoche is pretend time. You really think you can throw away theory, or back to Descartes, pretending to doubt that there's a hammer there at all, or that you're in the world. I mean, you can't actually make yourself, just because you say you're doubting it, you can't seriously do that. And you could say with Husserl, I mean, Husserl talks, yeah, okay, I know that when you reflect on an experience, you kind of change it, but still, there's enough of it intact, you can figure out what was going on there. Heidegger's going to say that's way more of a danger than you thought. Once you reflect on it, as you say, you've lost the immediacy of that experience, the experience of being unreflective. You can't capture that by reflecting on it exactly. Although strangely, again, Heidegger just did that.
I want to make the point that Heidegger doesn't think there's anything wrong with doing that. I think what he's saying is that in the process of doing that, this idea of the distinction between the world and you with this inner life and this subjectivity and the world as existing in space and having an objective reality and us wondering whether we're in touch with that objective reality or not. And he says what's happened is in the process of doing that, we forget or we cover up this more fundamental relationship we have to the world, which obviates any kind of radical skepticism and obviates the need to have arguments of the type that Descartes has led us through. I don't think he's saying that you can't think of things that way. Far from it. In fact, you can, and it's an important activity. That's what science is. Science is objectifying the world and turning it into quote-unquote nature and then coming up with propositions about it, and that's all well and good. But when you assume that the way scientists treat nature, treat the world, is the same way that human beings should be treated, so to speak, ontologically, like we are the same as trees and cars and televisions and all that kind of stuff, and that becomes a problem for us, then you've made a mistake. That's the error of the history of philosophy.
Well, the way you stated it seems like a horrible straw man. Most philosophers take great pains in the history to say, oh, we are different than everything else in creation. We are rational animals. I know what point you're trying to make is that, for instance, Descartes, by saying we are a thinking thing, oh, we're a thing, we're a substance, that just put us in the same ontological category as the things of our perception. Oh, well, we're thinking things and those are extended things. Okay, there's a difference there, but still they're things and there's some problem with that.
Yes, that is what I was trying to say.
Okay.
So are we thinking things? Are we social things? Are we created things? The problem is that we think of ourselves as things. But in order to figure out what we are, to answer the question of the meaning of being, we have to start with the being of us, Dasein. We have to kind of take ourselves as the topic for investigation. And that in itself is problematic because you can't, there's no abstraction. There's no way to step outside of who you are or where you are or life. And that's why he adopts phenomenology.
I want to make sure we have the transition that happens right there in the introduction to why we have to engage on this analytic of Dasein, which is the entirety of the first half of the book, or maybe the entirety of the book. Because he starts, you know, oh, we haven't really thought about what being is, that you use this word is all the time, but you've never defined it. You have medieval theologians talking about the existence of God versus our existence. Well, God is such a different kind of creature than our. How could we even use the word exists with God and the word exists with us? But by the time you get to Descartes, we're ignoring that issue. And so all modern philosophy, even though medieval philosophy, Heidegger says, was actually pretty piss poor when it came to analyzing, at least they gave it a shot in talking about theological issues like that and say, oh, you know, God is only analogically exists. We'll use that word for him just because, you know, that's the closest we can come. But we can't really understand anything about God. But they didn't pursue the more fundamental investigation that he wants to. Well, it seems like in all this, you could say, yeah, you're right. We should talk about what the meaning of is. And it seems that the transition that Heidegger gives to why then we have to analyze ourselves is just that, oh, well, we're the kind of being who's worried about this. We're the kind of being for which being is an issue. And so therefore, if we're going to figure out what being is, we have to analyze our own sensibilities, our own being, and that's how we'll... I guess I'm not seeing, that seems like a non sequitur to me, unless you're just saying, oh, it's kind of like the Kantian or the Cartesian perspective that, well, we have to start with ourselves because that's where we are. So let's just do some self-analysis. Maybe that'll tell us what being as a whole is.
I think there's one step in between there. He says there's no way to talk about being, at least at this point, we don't have the language for talking about being other than as the being of specific entities. So we can't talk about being in the abstract or in itself or by itself, but we can talk about the being of this chair or the being of Dasein or the being of a horse or something like that.
Also, those particular beings, I think we begin with Dasein, right? Because it's sort of the arena where those other things can disclose themselves. So the Da is the place, right, where the beings can show themselves. It's like saying that pre-Heideggerian, Husserlian, or Kantian might want to say, if we want to talk about objects, we have to talk about their constitution by the subject. I think Heidegger is, as you mentioned, Seth, trying to move beyond that, but I think there's a parallel in saying that to talk about beings, we must begin with Dasein, which is the place where they can exhibit themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Now, is there something special about the German word understanding that makes it so that it is not unambiguously mental? Like, isn't it verstanden, which sounds like you're standing on something about it? Because it seems like he's going out of his way. The way Wes just put it, you know, this is the arena where beings are disclosed. Well, that sounds, again, like Husserl's picture of his field of consciousness. Yeah. And that I know that Heidegger's big deal is, no, don't impose mind and consciousness on all this stuff. Like, we could have an understanding of something, you know, be a behaviorist about it, just because we're acting toward it in a certain way. I understand the hammer because I'm using it to hammer. That doesn't mean if I ask you, actually, the hammer is not even the best example of it. What about understanding your own hand? I mean, you're just using your hands all the time, but that doesn't mean that you could give a lot of anatomical data about it. So you could say you have an understanding without necessarily meaning anything mental by it.
I think understanding is one way of being. I mean, Heidegger would say one way of being. He's not going to say that in using the hammer, you understand the hammer.
Well, you pre-theoretically, you don't thematize it. You don't explicitly understand, but you have an understanding. Isn't that what the whole, you already have an understanding of being. It's just not spelled out. It's implicit. That's why we can make this investigation in the first place. If it was something entirely foreign to us, how could we even ask about it? How could we even know where to start looking? This has to be something that is pre-theoretically familiar to us.
Yes. And by the way, I'm the one using the word pre-theoretical. It's not in the book for anybody who's interested. He has a more tortured way of saying it. But the key is the way we use the word understanding presupposes something like an object that we think of as a substance with properties and so on and so forth. And if you want to think of it this way, you can say you can take that kind of a stance towards something in the world. You can decide that you want to understand something and you can think about its properties and make truth and make propositions about it and catalog it and so on and so forth. But he says that's not the normal way that we function. We don't normally function by thinking of things as objects, by trying to understand them. In fact, we don't try to understand most stuff. We just use it. And in the process of using it, we do not necessarily have any kind of knowledge about the objects other than the knowledge of their utility, how they're used for the purposes of doing something with them, which he suggests is not the same thing as knowing that it weighs this much, that it's this color, that it's a particular example of this type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it might just seem like it's nitpicking about words, that it's practical knowledge. And I do this, you know, with my kids all the time. How do we peel the potatoes? Okay, well, you know, this is the potato peeler. Here's how to hold it so you don't cut your finger. Don't do it too fast. There's all these things that I am telling him, facts that I am imparting. Now, they don't really mean what they're supposed to until he kind of gets in and does it. So there's certainly more to understanding than just having a set of facts, this knowing how versus knowing that. But there's nothing that tells me that, oh, this is not, I don't want to call this knowledge at all. He's just, now he's zen. He's unreflectively peeling.
Right. No, that's actually a really good example. Here's what I think Heidegger is trying to say. If you want to call that knowing and say there's knowing that this is a potato peeler and there's knowing how to use it. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. What Heidegger wants to say is you peel the potato because you're engaged in an activity whose end is to create mashed potatoes, which you intend to eat with your family. And he says that is what's the essential characteristic. That's really what it means to be Dasein, is to constantly be engaged in these kinds of activities that have an end, and that end usually involves other things and other Dasein in the world. And so what we are essentially is beings that do things, that have ends, that have goals in sight, and that all this activity that we undertake is for the purpose of achieving goals.
You still have to know how the damn thing works. There's still knowledge in play, seemingly.
What are you trying to save, or what are you trying to get at by saying there's knowledge in play?
Well, I guess I'm pointing at the fact that you haven't clarified, and I don't know if it was entirely clear to me. I mean, he's trying to get ultimately the fact that the kind of relationship that we have, the world that you're talking about, is more fundamental, is more a priori. And by that word a priori, he just means more fundamental. It's not a Kantian fancy term. If the idea of philosophy is an analysis of everything, we want to give a complete picture of the world. And if you think that to do that, you have to start by backing off and taking the scientific naturalist perspective, and you think that you can give an analysis and somehow reconstruct the world of meanings, our fundamental being toward the world in this goal-directed way, you're not going to be able to do it. That's his point.
Yeah, I think if you wanted to draw a contrast to Husserl, right, what are the phenomena with Husserl?
The ecological layers, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he's looking at this abstract structure of consciousness, you know, as a way of getting at the abstract structure of objects, almost in sort of a cognitive science, you know, even though it's not cognitive science, but he's interested in the type of things, right, a cognitive scientist might be interested in, it seems like. And with Heidegger, we're getting, it's almost as if the social and the historical are fundamental, right? Human beings are in the world, and their sort of practical interaction with it are fundamental. You don't start with a abstract explication of consciousness and build to those things. They're not derivative of it. They're going to be the primary things.
Ontologically primary. And that's why it's so crazy, because you could say, oh, sure, naturally, the scientific life, the theoretical life is exceptional and is an achievement and is something that we're abstracting away from all your natural purposes, right? Even philosophy itself, the fact that you're reflecting, you're breaking away, you know, that's not controversial.
And maybe there's another way I can try to respond to this. What Heidegger, I think, is trying to get at here is this. You are in the world in a particular way. And the way you are in the world is to constantly be engaged in activities and doing things. And you're doing them for a reason. And that is a fundamental, for lack of a better term, it's a fundamental characteristic of the being of Dasein, that it is constantly engaged in doing things that matter to it. we don't have to even talk about theoretical stuff like science. Mm-hmm. You know, we can talk about walking or learning how to use the potato peeler or whatever. Potato peeling never becomes an end in itself. It never becomes an activity in itself that matters to you, in the sense of you don't become like concerned about potato peeling and the structure of potato peeling. You peel potatoes so that you can cook potatoes, so that you can eat potatoes. You learn how to walk, but once you learn how to walk, you walk to get from one place to another. Mm-hmm. And you don't even think about it when you're doing it. You are never standing still, just contemplating something completely dispassionately for no reason. You always are disposed to be concerned about something for some reason and to be doing something for some purpose. That type of being, he thinks, is different from the type of inner subjectivity or transcendental subjectivity or any kind of abstracted self-consciousness or self that has been articulated so far in the history of philosophy.
Those articulations are all about objectivity, right? So what is Kant concerned with doing? You know, he gives us all these categories, beginning with causality and going on from there. He's trying to give us the fundamental structure of experience or the world. It goes both ways. And, right. And maybe Heidegger is making the point that the fundamental category that takes precedence over all that is care. It's this thing that's ignored by the concern with objectivity, is this relationship between the subject and the object. And that's what Kant is obviously concerned with in Husserl to a large extent.
I get the fact we're characterizing Heidegger as trying to demind a lot of the analyses that have come before him. So Husserl, following Brentano, said fundamentally consciousness, which again, I guess he thought is our fundamental relationship to the world, which is Heidegger's big beef with him, is intentionality, which is every bit of consciousness has an object. It is directed towards something or other. And Heidegger has a similar notion to that, but since he's not concerned with consciousness, Dasein itself, we have this fundamental orientation of engagement. So it's not exactly the same thing. In fact, Dreyfus says it's not intentionality at all. I guess you could say, you know, I'm fundamentally engaged with the activity of potato peeling or something. But that the way you described it is I'm not focusing, my consciousness is not focused on the potato peeler or on the potato, or even necessarily, I think there's a deeper analysis of being in the world that's even underlying any particular goal that we might have, just this overwhelming engagement we have with the world. So that's supposed to be some kind of analogical thing to Husserl's notion of intentionality, right?
Yeah, I've got notes on Dreyfus's lecture. Let me tell you how he explains the difference between things, and then we can talk about what you just asked about, Mark, if that's okay. All right. Heidegger's review of the history of philosophy, talking about the fact that we've had this idea of substance and that we think of things as substances means thinking of them atomistically. Mm-hmm. So if a thing is a thing, we think of it as a standalone thing. And a huge part of the problem is trying to find a way to bridge the relationships between things, like the issue with causality or knowledge and the subject-object distinction. The way Dreyfus puts it, Heidegger's genius is that he points out that the world doesn't exist atomistically. It exists holistically. So when he uses the example of the hammer, a hammer's way of being necessarily entails nails, wood, houses, people who want to build houses or chairs. You can't describe a hammer just based on its own atomic intrinsic properties. You have to describe it as something that's used in conjunction with all these other things for the purpose of accomplishing this by this type of person who has, you know, this, it's the whole holistic view. That is the type of being that Heidegger calls readiness to hand as opposed to presence to hand, or Zuhandenheit. And that is the way that Dreyfus characterizes the difference between the two with respect to objects.
Well, so he's, instead of giving this object-based ontology, right, what exists in the world, we're already, since he says we have to start with design and start with the relationship of phenomena to ourselves, so I'm really putting this in a Kantian, Cartesian, subjectivist sort of setup, with the proviso that we know that he's not focused on consciousness. Instead of trying to give an account of, oh, you know, do numbers exist in themselves? Do physical objects exist in themselves? Whatever he's talking about, the modes of being, he's appropriating this language of ontology in a way that It seems just a little pretentious to do it, but he certainly has his reasons for considering this all ontology. And the fact that it goes so deep, stuff we haven't talked about yet, is what really is bugging me about this. The fact that he talks about, you know, your emotions like anxiety are getting at something ontological. It really...
Well, in the case of the hammer, right, it's the idea that the objective description, you know, as a spatiotemporal object with this shape and...
Uh-huh.
So on and so forth, doesn't really capture what it is to be a hammer, right? It's a social sort of object.
Right. But that means that these are the ontological categories, right? You have the ontological category of presence to hand and readiness to hand. And in fact, the same object can be in two different categories depending on what stance we are taking toward it, right? So it makes ontology relative to us.
Yes. We determine the way of being of everything that we encounter in the world. I don't know how many different, and he only enumerates the three different categories here, the way of being of Dasein, the way of being of ready to hand, and the way of being of present to hand, but there could be more.
And the world as a whole, right?
That's not one of the ways of being.
The background, as Dreyfus puts it. So even when you're using a hammer, you've got the things you're immediately engaged with, but in order to say what a hammer is, you have to refer to this whole giant social structure, you know, what tools are in general, the fact that people make tools, there's all this human meaning layered within it, the fact that we have purposes, like you were saying, you know, that this is for building homes or building things and what building is and all that. And Dreyfus talks a lot about Heidegger's main concern here in elaborating our relationship toward being. We can only make sense of it by referring to this unarticulated background, which is the world itself. So being in the world means that we are in this social situation, I would say, with all these concepts that we know about or something, but that's clearly not the way Heidegger is going to talk about it, right? You have to just take the talk of concepts and knowing out of it. But okay, familiarity is the term Dreyfus uses a lot. Is that a mode of being? You know, the things, they're not all ready to hand. Not everything in the world is ready to hand. In fact, the world is a whole, right? It is not atomistically in terms of little individual bits. Or is our relationship to the world as a whole a ready to hand relationship, except insofar as we focus on one part of it and make it present to hand?
Let's talk about the world, I guess.
Just to narrow it down.
You know, we've kind of sort of laid out that Heidegger thinks there's this other type of being that's different from substance that he calls equipment. Okay, great.
Right. Things that are ready to hand. Yeah.
Things that are ready to hand, he calls equipment.
I shouldn't say things. Yeah.
Sorry. Yes. What is ready to hand is equipment. What is present to hand is substance or objects. So those are two different ways that things that are not us can be for us. One of the things that constitutes Dasein, special being, is A, it takes its own being as an issue for it. You know, I think
its own being is a question for it.
And another constituent part of Dasein is being in the world. And this world that is constitutive for Dasein, it's what socially constructs, so to speak, or it's what constructs Dasein. It's what socializes, it's what constitutes what a specific Dasein, what a specific being is, was, and the possibilities that it has to be.
Mm-hmm.
We're thrown into the world. You don't get to pick when you're born. You don't get to pick who your parents are. And you don't get to pick what culture, what era, what socioeconomic class you're born into. You're just essentially, think of it like you're thrown into the world at a particular point in time. You don't get to pick your gender, your hair color, your height. You don't get to pick any of that stuff. You're just thrown into the world. And that thrownness determines what you come to understand as all of the common practices and cultural things and social things that will ultimately dictate what you consider to be equipment and how you use it and what you consider to be objects that are present to hand and how you deal with them and so on.
Right. And that's the world. That's the background.
Right. And is it right to say that when we say that being is a issue for Dasein, you might think about that in terms of what is it that I'm going to be, you know, especially given those, the constraints of thrownness, right? I have all these possibilities of what it is that I can be or become, and that's an issue for me. Will I be a lawyer? Will I be this type of person? Will I be that? That's one of the important characteristics of Dasein, right?
If you take it in a very non-mental way.
Absolutely. Those are the key things. There are two elements to what you just said, Wes, that nail it on the head. One, that you take a stance towards your own being. You care about it and you have concern. And the other part is you look to the future. You project into the future. So you have a concern about doing things and becoming some things or having things or whatever the case may be. And that whole structure of being that way is what differentiates Dasein from all other kinds of beings. You know, I have cats. Cats care about their own preservation. They can show affection. They might get hungry and worry about where they're going to get their food. But a cat doesn't wonder about its future and look towards its own potential end and build plans and strive towards things. That's what differentiates Dasein.
That's why they look so happy all the time.
Exactly. I wish I could sleep 14 hours a day and not give a shit about anything.
I'm not understanding how this, the way you've described it, and that's the way I, you know, normally understand it. That's why he's so, you know, one of the fathers of existentialism, and his description of Dasein there sounds a lot like Kierkegaard's, the self is a relation that relates itself to itself. But at least according to the Dreyfus interpretation, you can interpret this as navel gazing and introspection as to well, what kind of person should I be? How can I evaluate? It all comes down to action, and that we determine our being through our action, through actions we take on roles. So this makes it very much like the Sartrean kind of existentialism. By your every action, you are putting yourself on the line. You're not just this predetermined substance that can put itself in certain positions. You're actually determining your being. We are creatures without essence. So by acting in a certain way, we are, right? That captures this, what I was referring to as pretentious use of ontological terms to talk about everyday behaviors. And that's a way of getting around saying, oh, I'm wondering and I'm thinking about what I'm going to be. And I'm trying to get a self-conception that, no, none of that is, it's what you do, right? That's how we demonstrate that our being is an issue for us, because we make choices between paths of what to do.
Well, I think you just gave a very Sartrean reading of it.
That's what I was about to say.
I don't think Heidegger would say that introspection is an activity that we undertake. Of course we do that. There's nothing wrong or irregular about that. We can also be indifferent, right? We can have ennui. We can profess to not give a shit. I mean, there's a lot of different stances we can take. But the point is, we do take some kind of stance. We do care or consciously choose not to care about these sorts of things. That's just what differentiates us from trees and rocks and foxes. I mean, but he's trying to say, as Dasein, a fundamental characteristic of the being of being Dasein is caring. He says one of the fundamental characteristics of Dasein is care. One is being in, namely being in the world. Another is care.
Well, and care is that analog to intentionality that I was talking about, right?
Yes. Yep. To bring it back to that, it's an analog to intentionality, except that he would say that care can manifest itself in lots of different ways. You can find something scary. You can be angry. You can love. You can hate. You can be indifferent. You can be bemused. You know, we're never neutral with respect to having some kind of disposition over against some activity or something. So that's the analog. I don't know how tight the parallel is. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, I passed out before you guys solved all the Husserl problems last time.
Yeah.
So, yes, we always take some kind of stance vis-a-vis what's going on in the world and in our lives. And we undertake activities in order to do things that we expect to get realized in the future. And that's really, really important.
You know, I took being in time with me on my Christmas traveling. And so I was, in fact, sitting around in a doctor's office for a while where my mom was being treated. And I was with my sister and my dad and her. And I was reading some of Being in Time aloud to intelligent people who are not philosophy people. And they made me stop. And very, very soon, because, and this is the reason I'm saying this now, because It's like it was taking him so long and circumspectly and putting in all these difficult words to say like what a hammer is. And I picture people listening to this and saying, okay, Seth has now said for the third time, yeah, we have goals. We're concerned with things. Like, really? You had to write a book to...
No.
Again, we started with the question of being, but it's very hard to see how this stuff that he's talking really addresses what the question of being is, other than, oh, if you think everything's a substance and you treat us as things, then you're missing this stuff. You need to take a more humanistic approach to these kind of things. But he does way more than that. He goes out of his way to sort of slide all these really everyday observations that you're talking about into this ontological terminology and to root it historically so that you could see, you know, if you look at the Greek derivation of, you know, the notion of truth or whatever and go back in time, then you'll see that, oh, okay, these ways that Descartes and Kant were talking about it were wrong and we need to get at this more fundamental thing, which lets us see what's right in front of our face all the time. The fact that things are equipment, for instance, that should be obvious to us, but no philosopher before Heidegger has ever thematized it, has ever made this a theme for ontology because it's just too close for us. We have to somehow back off to be able to see the obvious. One of the parallels he gives is, you know, the glasses on your face, even though those could be ontically the closest possible thing to you. In other words, the glasses are right there on your face, but ontologically is extremely far from us because it's really hard for us to focus on it and grasp its true significance or to realize it's even there. So I guess I just in one speech said, this sounds useless, but it's not.
I got confused there. Listen, Mark, I agree with you. I mean, I think probably when he wrote this book, this is a really radical thing to say within philosophy, right? If you tell somebody, nobody who's listening to this podcast, who's a normal human being, is going to be like, wow, I just learned something about human nature. But for Heidegger to say, we have been screwing up ontology and we've been engaged in this misguided activity called metaphysics for hundreds and hundreds of years just because we're overlooking this. And I'm trying to raise the fact that we need to turn around and look at it. And he's trying to draw attention to it and say, okay, if it were the case that this is a fundamental part, this is a way of being of Dasein, what is that ultimately going to mean for ontology? He says, you know, that this is just preparatory, blah, blah, blah. And he ends up throwing away the project of trying to do being in time. He never finishes it, right? So maybe he realized what you're pointing out, which is he was right. It is somehow critical to doing ontology, but there's no way to thematically get to it by doing some sort of big exposition or whatever, which is why in the later part of his life, he spends time reading these poets and talking about architecture and stuff like that. And this is another reason why I think he gets criticized, right? There are a lot of people who are like, well, he just took this idea from so-and-so. Like, this is an amalgamation of Kant, Hegel, Descartes, Husserl, Kierkegaard, Schopenhauer, Brentano, and Diltai. And he's just kind of brought them all together, and he didn't create anything new, and he never actually accomplishes the goal he brings all these people together to do. That's certainly one interpretation of this. At the same time, he had such a profound influence on so many people, and there were lots of people who clearly saw that he was right to criticize the project of Western metaphysics, and he sort of mainstreamed existentialism in a way that Kierkegaard hadn't, I don't think, and also provided a context for all of this other stuff. He's on to something.
Yeah, maybe we could try and say what that, because I don't know that I fully understand the critique of metaphysics of Descartes and the rest, because just saying that, well, you've been wasting your time with the subject-object distinction, that in itself isn't persuasive to me. But let me try and get at my understanding of this, and you guys should say something about what he's actually done, you know, that's revolutionary with regard to metaphysics. But as I take it, the introduction of this, let's say, category of care as being fundamental, I could see Kant coming back and saying, well, okay, that's great. You want to do sociology and history and empirical psychology. Those are great disciplines, but that's not philosophy, right? And you might see care as something that comes after, you know, Kant is concerned with how do we ground objectivity and what are the grounds for the possibility of experience and so on and so forth. And he gives all those cognitive categories, and he might say something like care isn't fundamental to that, and emotions and all sorts of other things are an issue. Mm-hmm. For empirical psychology, they're not really fundamental to subjectivity as such, and they don't really do anything for objectivity. But if I understand what Heidegger's response might be, it's that, well, actually, care is integral to being. It's not just an add-on. It's a sort of an accidental part of consciousness that comes after you've established objectivity. It's down there in the guts. It's fundamental. It is something that you can't do without. Kant loves that phrase, grounds for the possibility of experience. Well, it's one of those grounds of experience and being as such. That's something I have to think about more, but that's the way I understand right now what he's doing. That's modifying the traditional metaphysics and epistemology.
Right, that's a fundamental part of Dasein's being, right? Just to clarify, care, again, is a technical term which has to do with our engagement with the world for purposes. And you could say, well, there are lots of times when I don't have a particular purpose or whatever. And Heidegger seems to characterize times like that of like, oh, no, no, you're still fundamentally in the mode of care. You're just in a deficient appearance of the mode or something like that.
Yeah, I don't like that. I hear what you're saying.
I think an easier to understand one is with people, that we are fundamentally being with others. Well, what if you're on an island? No, you're still fundamentally being with others because you're a social creature. You think in terms of, you know, if you actually were dropped as a baby on the island and never saw another person, then okay, you wouldn't have that fundamental being with as Dasein. But the fact that you were socialized at all means that you are in the ontological mode of being with, even if you're not physically with anyone. And it's the same thing. So you're in the ontological mode of care, even if you don't give a crap about anyone and you don't have any particular goals and you're just a slacker.
Just to go back to the contrast, right? So for Kant, Kant's interested in causality. I just want to compare causality and care. And maybe that's helpful. For Kant, there's no such thing as objects without causality, and there's no such thing as experience without causality. Something like care never comes into that picture. You know, that never grounds what it means to be an object or an experiencer. You could do without it. It's accidental. It's nowhere there in what's essential to being a subject or an object. And I know, to get to Heidegger, it's not subject-object exactly, but you could say that if you thought causality is in some way foundational to being for Kant, and care is accidental, with Heidegger it seems like the revolutionary thing is to say, well, no, it's actually foundational. There's no such thing as being without that.
Well, and what does foundational mean? Because that's the key. It's to redefine what foundational means, is to say that instead of what's basic is substances, and you can kind of build those up, and eventually, if you get into empirical psychology, you can talk about people having purposes, and they have mental things, and maybe we want to reduce those to talk of physical things, and maybe we don't. But in any case, that's the overall ontological picture. No, no, no. That's not taking the fact that we start from our own point of view seriously. We need to start from our own point of view where things are meaningful. They just are meaningful. We don't, if you say, really, we just experience sense data or these physical objects and we add meaning to them, that's just a bullshit theory that you're imposing on the phenomena. What the phenomena tell us is that things are meaningful, that we are engaged with things in this care relationship fundamentally. And in fact, it's an abstraction to get to the kind of things that empirical science talks about. Like his,
I think that's a great way of putting it.
Like this account of space, the fact that, you know, you think the space of Euclid, you know, that's the fundamental thing. And that's kind of the way Kant talks about it is that just, you know, to have any experience at all, we have to experience it in towards using this three-dimensional going to infinity in every direction. There's uniform distances and you can count them in every direction. No, but for Heidegger, the world that we live in, the space that we live in has to include a here and a yonder, and its distances are not what you measure with a ruler, but it's kind of how far away is something? Well, how long is it going to take you to get there? How much trouble is it to get there? And we can abstract away from all our particular purposes and just take out a ruler and measure things, but we got to understand that that's derivative. That's just a partial representation of the world. The world in itself has all these meanings in it, these human things fundamentally.
Yes.
Nice.
That's very well put, Mark. And the only other piece to add to that is not just space, but time. We have the exact same thing with time. And that is a critical, fundamental part of being. Dasein is temporality. Just as we saw, I think, in Husserl and also in Schopenhauer, the idea that temporality is fundamental to being.
And I like Husserl's image of it, that you can analyze experience into these what he calls these egological layers that you can talk about. Yeah, okay, I can talk about the physical properties of what's in front of me. I can talk about the anticipations that I have of other, the fact that I'm looking at this book and I anticipate that it has a back. I can also talk about the social layers of meaning, the fact that I perceive it as a book and not as a physical object that's this tall with a certain bumps or whatever, the fact that I understand not only that it has pieces of paper in it, but what those are for, and the fact that, you know, somebody wrote it and somebody printed it and all this stuff, that, you know, these layers of meaning, I guess it wasn't clear to me from the Husserl, and I don't know what he really thinks about this, which ones are basic, which ones are primordial. In some ways, I mean, the only way to figure that out is just look at the phenomena themselves. Certainly that's what Heidegger is doing here. He's looking at that phenomenon and saying, okay, then yeah, the meaning ones, those are the primordial ones. The fact that it is a book, because when you actually think about how we deal with a book, when we're not engaging in explicit theorizing or phenomenological exploration, we understand that that's how we see it first, right? As a book, not as a doorstop or something, you know. Mm-hmm. But then I think back to our Nelson Goodman conception, which is Nelson Goodman's idea would be to say, look, you could come up with a world, he would call it, that counts any one of these layers as basic, and you could use that world for certain purposes. So if you don't like the world, you could throw it away and use something else. But you could say, okay, for the purposes of natural science, we're going to take the physical properties as basic. For the purposes of literary criticism, we're going to take the fact that it's a book as basic. And neither of those is really more fundamental than any other. It just depends on what your purpose is for it. And the fact that Heidegger is stressing that, oh, the world is not atomic, the world is holistic. Well, again, somebody like Goodman can say it's atomic for certain purposes, it's holistic for other purposes. If you're considering these kind of analyses that Heidegger's been giving, yes, okay, then his ontology makes sense for that. But don't call one of these the basic ontology and one of these derivative. There's no justification for that.
Yeah, I hear Seth sighing here.
No, I don't think that's so. I get where that criticism is coming from, and I would respond to it this way. I think what Heidegger would say is there are multitudes of activities that we engage in where we create what Goodman would call a world. We use objects or we act in such ways that we narrow the scope and make some kind of activity or some sort of disposition primary. But it's still fundamental to human activity or Dasein that we do things, we care about what we're doing or don't care about it, and we have reasons for why we're doing those things. That's the fundamental stuff that's there. And if you say, oh, well, I'm going to go to the gym and work out because I want to get healthy, because I want to live a long life, and you prioritize that, and I prioritize cigar smoking and eating red meat and drinking wine, we're still both fundamentally engaged in activities that we have a certain disposition toward, and we have a future state, a future goal that we're trying to achieve. That structure is the fundamental structure. There's nothing beneath that, so to speak. You can't not do anything. You can't not act, because even not to act is still,
it's a deficient, you know, it's still mode
fundamentally
of
part of human.
Yes. Since what it's so obvious that care, as he's defining it, is such a central part of us, you know, it's hard to argue with that. But if you look at the way that mode of argumentation that you just gave, that if it looks like there's a contrary, then you just say it's a deficient mode of, or it presupposes by its negation the thing that you're arguing against. So I really think that everybody is all about prairie dogs. You might deny that everybody's about prairie dogs, but the fact that you're denying that, it like presupposes the prairie dogness of things. How could you, you're deny? Do you see what I'm saying? It's a bullshit form of argument.
But this isn't intended to be an argument. It's intended to, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but what I'm saying is this. If you're a human being and you say, I'm not going to do anything, that doesn't change your essential nature from a thing that acts to a thing that doesn't act. In fact, you are acting. You are acting by not acting. You get what I mean?
Sure.
That's what I'm trying to say. That's not an argument. I'm just trying to point out that as a human being, you can't choose not to be an active entity with dispositions towards things. It's not possible.
So does that sound like it's your essence? So in other words, he's not an existentialist. This is our essence, to be active beings.
He's not an existentialist the way Sartre is. Yes. No, this is what we talked about earlier. No.
But we didn't fill it out because it actually says in Being and Time here in the part we read, our existence is prior yeah. to our essence and we don't really have an. And you could see, so Dreyfus characterizes all of Sartre's being nothingness as a misreading of Being in Time, that his emphasis on the fact that Heidegger gives all this setup for what sounds like existentialist, you know, you choose your own being and you push yourself in different directions and, the way he talks about emotions is ontological, all this stuff comes out in Sartre. But I guess Heidegger didn't actually believe any of that, or else he wouldn't have been such a bad person.
No. Did you see the YouTube video clip of Dreyfus being interviewed by Brian McGee that Daniel put up?
I will watch it.
He spends like, I don't know, 5 minutes talking about Husserl, and then the rest of the five clips are almost all about Heidegger. But Dreyfus went to visit Heidegger, he mentions in this video. And apparently Being in Nothingness was sitting on the table. And Dreyfus said, oh, you're reading Being in Nothingness. And Heidegger said, I can't read that crap. Literally used the German word Dreck, which means crap. So just to get back to your point, I don't think Heidegger would agree with Sartre on that point.
So where are we? How are we doing with the question of being?
Yeah, well, we'll never get to the question of being, because all we're doing is spelling out the being of Dasein in this thing.
We already said a lot about, at least by example, how his way of doing phenomenological examination is different from Husserl's, which I always find it hard to characterize this, because it just seems like, okay, Husserl has this very well-defined epoche and things. Heidegger thinks that doesn't work. And so what's his alternative? Well, I'm analyzing the history of philosophy and the history of how words were used to try to get at what people meant by being. I mean, it really all comes down to being, whereas Husserl's phenomenology is really open to the full. This is just how Heidegger characterizes it himself, at least in one place. But it seems like Husserl's phenomenology is open to the full range of human experience, even though he himself focuses mostly on perception. But other folks like Sartre talk about other parts of experience. But Heidegger's is really, phenomenology is all about getting the underlying being of things. Of what being is apart from beings, the being that beings have, right? And that has to do with what he thinks phenomena are.
I don't even know that most people would even call what he's doing phenomenology. It's certainly not phenomenology like Husserl intended, which is why Husserl backed away and from the book after it was published. Heidegger basically says, look, I want to answer this question, what is the meaning of being? In order to answer the question, what is the meaning of being, I can only look at beings, because there's no such thing as being out there that I can study. So I'm going to look at beings. Well, the best way to look at beings is not to take a scientific approach or an analytic of the sort that Kant does. The best thing to do is to look at how things actually are in the world. Look at how the world is. Look at how the world presents itself. Look at the phenomena.
Right. You know, presents itself.
There have been people who said that his etymology is very spurious. I'll leave it to Wes to judge. But his conception of phenomenology, he's trying to reach back to this Greek use of the term. He thought the Greeks had a way of thinking about things where they allowed them to present themselves to people as they were in themselves. He thinks that objectivity and the form of the ideas in Plato, all that stuff we talked about, substances, objects, ideas, these things change the way that we see the world, and having a theoretical structure in place prevents us, so to speak, from seeing things as they are in themselves. Mm-hmm. And his intention, what he thinks phenomenology is that it's going to allow things to show themselves as they are in themselves and not through some kind of lens. So this whole existential analytic of Dasein is intended to be an exercise in letting it show itself, which is why it sounds, why the wording is so weird and why he's got all this Greek. And, you know, he thought that German was the only true heir as an expressive language to Greek, which is yet more of, you know, his naivete and his nationalism and all this stuff that came out.
There's some argument for that.
I don't disagree, but it's ridiculously arrogant and stupid to say that the language I speak is the best language for philosophy. You know, I mean, it's just, come on.
Well, any language where you can simply run together words to make a new word is inherently philosophical.
Yeah. So phenomenology for Husserl, it was a methodology, and it was a methodology that was intended to be scientific. And what Heidegger's trying to do with phenomenology here is tease out meaning. You know, he mentions hermeneutics, and hermeneutics is originally a way of textual interpretation that was intended to tease out meaning. And it goes way, way, way back, right? There's biblical hermeneutics, and I mean, it's well established. And Heidegger was doing a form of philosophical hermeneutics, which is why he plays around with language and looks at old Greek and Latin terms and the roots of words. And he's trying to get to an understanding that is not necessarily scientific.
You mentioned the way he analyzes the ancient Greek being suspect. I don't think it's suspect, but I think it reminds me exactly what I was doing when I was studying ancient Greek, and I was very excited, and I saw it as this sort of portal to things you couldn't think about otherwise. And there's a free association element that goes on, right? The way you use the ancient language to think about things differently.
When I say Heideggerian call for St. John's, it's not like we studied Heidegger. It's that the whole reverent attitude towards the ancient Greeks was there, and the whole approach and this looking at the ancient language in this way. It's not like he's giving a strict analysis of Phinistai in the ancient Greek. I think he's free associating to get ideas out of it, which at the same time, on the one hand, I was irritated a little bit because I have a little bit of bitterness about my level of reverence. It's like someone who's been religious and who's no longer religious. That's sort of my relationship to that type of, you know, that was going to be my life, and to be that kind of philosopher was going to be my life. So I have that, like anyone who's had a sort of faith and is disillusioned, I have that bitterness towards it. But on the other hand, I think it's useful to look at language in that way. And I've actually, you know, I enjoyed, like reading Heidegger was really shocking, just because I'd never seriously read him. And it's shocking in the sense of how much of this I was exposed to indirectly through my study of the ancient Greeks and the environment that I did it in.
I think people that haven't read any of this are probably scratching their heads right now, because we haven't given any examples. We're not going to go through the etymological details, but for instance, when he decides what phenomenology means, he says, oh, you know, there's the phenom and there's the logos. And then he talks about the ancient Greek meaning to these words and how this really should tell us what phenomenology should be, as opposed to, say, what Husserl said it was. So, like, I think for the phenom part, it has to do, in the ancient Greek, it had something to do with rising up, the emergence, the birth of something. Or is that the analysis of being? I might be confusing my...
No, but your point is correct. So first off, for anybody who hasn't seen the text, all of the Greek is actually in the Greek alphabet. It's all these long these words and sentences in the Greek lettering. So if you can't read Greek, it won't do you any good.
It translates it in the back, in the end notes. Anyway.
It's too much work to flip to the back.
Didn't occur to me.
But he does things like, he says, oh, well, phenomenology comes from the two Greek words phenomenon and logos. And then he talks about the root of phenomenon is phagon or whatever, which means to rise up or to appear in itself, you know, that kind of thing. So he tries to break things down to these root meanings and then say, oh, you know, the original meaning of phenomenon was a thing which shows itself in itself as it appears to, you know, like these long, and he tries to tease the meaning out that way. There are disagreements about whether or not certain words come from certain roots and what those roots actually mean and all that. And so there are a lot of people that criticize Heidegger because he does a lot of that stuff in his later writings, lots and lots of yes. playing around with language. And that's what annoys the shit out of most Anglo-American philosophers and what delighted the French.
And it also annoys them because he's making a very anti-analytical point with all of that. In his analysis of logos, logos does not mean judgment, he says. And he'll get to the point where he talks about discourse, logos mm-hmm. as discourse, as letting something be seen. And it sounds kind of touchy-feely in the end and quasi-mystical, but he wants to talk about logos instead of as judgment, as this letting something being seen. And that, and all the talk of getting back to the pre-Socratics and being, I can see the irritation with that, you know? I mean, I feel some of that. I'm attracted to it at the same time that I'm irritated by it.
You're a self-hating classicist.
Exactly. Exactly.
It goes along with his conservatism, his provincialism, or mm-hmm. whatever. I think it was in the Introduction to Metaphysics lecture that I was reading the beginning of that he was saying something like, there's no progress. He just kind of says this out of nowhere. Like, things start great and then they get crummier and crummier. And that's just the way things work, and that's the way you should expect them to work. The specific application to this in particular is when people come up with these words, these first philosophers, these people before Socrates, they were in touch with the phenomena themselves. But then once their words harden into doctrine and they are passed on to the next person, then it kind of gets more and more obscured and false as it's passed down. And so that's what he's doing, that we need to unravel the history of these things to figure out what the phenomena were that really the originals we're reacting to. What's the grain of truth that's hidden in all these centuries of increasing error?
Yeah, and it sounds almost like a Christian conception of the fall, right? And salvation. And it's not works that's going to get you there. It's faith, or it's not science and judgment and the analytical approach that's going to get you there, but it's this being receptive to the uncovering or something like that.
Right. The uncovering, that's the part of the phenomenon that I wanted to point out, that this is how he's different from Husserl. And this is, again, I mentioned what Fritjof Bergmann just hated about him, that his whole thing of like what was great about continental philosophy, starting with Hegel, is there's no thing in itself lurking behind the appearances. We are connected in knowledge with the things in themselves. There is nothing beyond that.
Or the things themselves, just to
The things themselves. Yes. Even though Heidegger, you know, we've already characterized that, yes, our being in the world means we are interacting with the world, not with our own appearances. So it seems like Heidegger has a hold of that. But at the same time, he talks about phenomena as it's not the appearances, it's the thing behind the appearances that appears. And these are both parts of experience broadly construed. But as you say, it's letting the things appear as themselves, that some things, they appear as something else. In other words, they give a false impression so that when you dig deeper, you'll
the
see.
Seeming.
Yes. So he goes through these different, in his analysis of the phenomenon, of these different ways we use the word appearance and how that's all very confusing. But ultimately, what it's going to come down to is that any of these significant truths are veiled. They're hidden, just like the glasses on our face or the way that we use tools unreflectively or our fundamental being toward the world. Since as soon as we theorize about them, they're hidden by these theories and things, by the history of philosophy that's already weighing down on us, just by our ordinary attitude towards the world. Just the fact that we tend to treat things as objects. And so we want to treat ourselves as objects too. Like there's just all these things built in from various levels that will obscure the truth from us. So phenomenology is letting that which is veiled come forth and be analyzed, and very non-Husserlian.
Yeah, and the way he talks about it, it makes it sound like language is that veil, right? And I think we're talking about the introduction, part 2A, the concept of phenomenon, just for listeners.
Uh-huh.
Section,
yep.
Margin pages 29 and onwards. It's as if the signifier, whatever symbol is being used, is the thing that immediately shows itself to the senses, right? And the concept is not a seen thing. So it's something we've talked about before with language. What's signified is not a image, or it's not an object of the senses. And so it sort of remains unseen.
Mm-hmm.
So automatically, this sort of discursive way of talking about things sets up this opposition between that which shows itself in itself and then the not showing itself.
Right.
Which I take to be something conceptual.
This was a useful thing that it points at, I think, ultimately what I at least got out of the lectures as being his view of truth. And ultimately, we still haven't talked about what being as opposed to these different modes of being is. And at least one of the ways that Dreyfus kind of guesses at it, based on a couple comments that Heidegger makes in here, is that it's intelligibility, which is just the same thing as I've been saying as, he's all doing ontology as related to people as opposed to ontology, the world in itself or something. You know, we have to start from our own perspective. And so if you have to say what being, capital B, is, at least one of the ideas that Dreyfus toys with, he ends up not liking this, not thinking that that's exactly right, but is that it's just how we can understand things, their intelligibility to us. So that explains like why ready to hand and presence to hand could be modes of being. These are just ways that we can understand objects and our relation toward them. Or again, I shouldn't even use that word objects, but the phenomena. You can see by this term phenomena, the way he's using it is they're not just the appearances, or even like Husserl talked about them, these appearances that include transcendence within them. I mean, Heidegger says some similar things to that, but he doesn't mean it in exactly the same way as Husserl's talk of, every physical object has horizons of other potential appearances. That's not all there is to transcendence. And so he seems to have more available to him, I think, Heidegger, in being able to talk about truth as hiddenness, or what truth is the revelation of something that was hidden. And so it's another alternative. I'm just dwelling on this. We obviously won't be able to go on this in any detail, but because we talked about it so much in our pragmatism episode and last time, that yes, Heidegger too has to have a view of truth that's coming from the same area, in terms of it can't be the correspondence of things we experience with something far off and unexperienceable, but at the same time, it can be the correspondence, if you even want to use the term correspondence, of a particular seeming with the phenomena that's causing that seeming, which sounds very similar to something that Husserl actually says.
So I'll just throw this out there to address the last two points you guys both brought up. One is, the works after this, the later works, he spends a lot more time playing with language, exactly to Wes's point, that he stops trying to actually accomplish systematic things by, you know, making them clear, but instead actually engaging, like the doing. And so some of his essays seem really lunatic and bizarre because he's playing with language.
Prickish.
And he's taking, it's definitely, yeah, definitely arrogant. And Mark, he has a more developed theory of truth, if you will, later on. That's exactly what you described, namely that truth is the uncovering of something that's hidden. But he points out that it actually has the characteristic of hiding something simultaneously. So the seeming of something, if you see it in one particular way, it means that you're not seeing it in another way. And so his theory of truth, which he ties into a view of history, is that we go through these historical epochs where things are revealed, aka they're true in one way, but it hides something else. So when, you know, the medieval way of viewing the world was true for medievals, but it hid the previous Greek way of viewing the world, and obviously precluded the more modern view that we have, like in the world of science, you know, like we can't view the world the way the Greeks did, for example. We can't view the world the way the medievals did. And because of that, we have a tendency to think of them as being wrong or simplistic or naive or what have you. But that's how he thinks truth works. As far as getting at what being is, I remember Dreyfus mentioning the word intelligible and then almost immediately backing off of it because it does weigh too much on the kind of knowing, knowledge, scientific aspect. A better word might be significance. Being is just that thing that makes things significant for us. It makes us significant to ourselves and makes things significant to us as tools, as objects of knowledge, as love interests, as beautiful.
Which looks pretty obviously, and he has a reason for this, but it looks like it prejudges the issue, right? If you're trying to figure out, sort of stepping back from Heidegger's project and specifically like, is everything just ideas? Is everything material objects in the world that would be there, whether any humans were around or not? Well, he's going to say, we can't even really talk like that. And this sounds very similar to the way we were describing Husserl last time, or the way we described Schopenhauer or Kant. Because we're starting from our standpoint, we have to talk about the way things show up to us. So, oh, surprise, surprise, the fundamental property at the bottom of all of it, being, is about how they show themselves up to us. Oh, amazing. It's kind of a circular enterprise, but that's what phenomenology is about. You're describing experience, and this is what experience tells you, is that everything experienced is experienced, or, you know, everything that we can consider is considered by us, or everything is in relation to us. That, you know, it shouldn't be a surprise that that's the way it shows up, because that's the way we're looking at it.
It's the hermeneutic circle.
Yeah.
So you could just be aggravated by that and try to go back to a naturalistic standpoint, but you have to at least come to terms with that argument that Heidegger and I think Husserl have, that naturalism is incoherent, that you can't presuppose, you can't abstract away from the fact that we are humans with a whole system of meanings to think about us as physical objects, animals with maybe some idea stuff or a soul substance or whatever. All that's just jamming theory on top of it. You know, when I'm saying it, it actually doesn't sound as bad. I'm not reproducing Heidegger's critique at all. Do you have anything to make that a little more incisive against what's wrong with the naturalist, or is this getting too far afield?
I couldn't speak intelligently to it. I'm not sure.
All right. We will have to return to that. For instance, Dreyfus, the big Heideggerian, is a major figure in the philosophy of mind. So we talked about guys like Nagel and Searle giving critiques of artificial intelligence, and some of what came out of the lectures that I got was he's telling the story of, and he's got some very famous papers like What Computers Can't Do, I think is one of them, or What Computers Still Can't Do is another. And he was just a major critique of the way artificial intelligence is being done. He's not necessarily against all artificial intelligence, but artificial intelligence on the Husserlian Cartesian paradigm, which is that everything we do is a matter of, you know, knowing a set of rules, for instance. Just the idea, it should be obvious from what we've said already, if Heidegger is de-emphasizing mind, then you can't think that our fundamental way of relating to the world is having a explicit set of instructions, even if it's not instructions we think about. So if you try to program a computer to understand a story, for instance, by giving it a bunch of rules for how things work in the world, it never works. You have to program in so many rules that then the computer doesn't know which rules to follow to interpret the story. And you have to have it, you know, create meta rules pointing which rules you should. So this is just pointing at that this atomistic view where it's the mind having a finite set of atomic facts, you might say, that it knows about the world. That's somehow how we understand things and how we build significance, how we can account for our whole experience of things. That doesn't work. So straight following Heidegger, Dreyfus has this whole theory that maybe we'll sometime read about in one of our next Philosophy of Mind episodes about why you have to take a more holistic interpretation. And, you know, if you do use artificial intelligence, maybe it's a neural network model or some different kind of thing. So there's that direction. There's the existentialism direction. Seth, did you want to say a little, give us a 3-minute summary?
Yes, I'll give you the 3-minute summary. We have the structure of Dasein as being care and pressing into the future, always doing something towards which. So if you think about what are the structural elements, right? One of the things that's in our future as Dasein is not being Dasein anymore, aka death. It's one fundamental experience that we all share. So he describes something that he calls Angst vor dem Tod, or anxiety before death, that is essentially this unsettling feeling that we have knowing that sometime in the future we will not be anymore. And this is a very scary and difficult thing to deal with. And so he says, in a very Kierkegaardian way, you have to face up to this fact. You have to own up to the fact that you're going to die. And if you do that, then you begin to live authentically. And if you flee from this anxiety, then you live inauthentically. And there are lots of different ways that you can flee. If we think about the Camus episode we did 100 years ago, it feels like, if you can overcome the anxiety of death, then you're not going to have anxiety or fear about the regular things in life. And also, you will come to realize that you are solely responsible for making your life into a meaningful project. You have to sort of find your own meaning. Trying to find meaning for existence elsewhere, like outside, like in God or faith or works or whatever, is living inauthentically. That's it in a nutshell.
Okay. And you touch on some of the other elements of it already. The fact that we're born into a certain situation, that's our, you know, our affecticity, and the fact that we have this structure of care. We're usually absorbed in the world and not thinking about, that means we're not thinking about being authentic, right? So that's fallenness, right? So he has these other, it's worth, seemingly worth throwing out the basic terms so that, assuming that we're not going to do an actual episode on his form of existentialism, when we do get to Sartre, useful to have these out there. It's a lot of the analogs, if you've listened to the Camus episode, to what he was talking about there, but done in his much more convoluted way that apparently you say, Seth, does not entail any particular, even to the Nietzschean or Sartrean extent, constitutes an ethics.
No, I don't think so. And believe me, lots of people have tried to find it.
So it's not that Heidegger was being hypocritical in, say, joining the Nazi party. It's just that most of his stuff, even though it had something to do with existentialism, didn't get specific enough such that he was worrying. It's, you know, it's all very delving in deep into the nature of being in ontology and not giving himself specific armor for resisting herd mentality in the way that would have been required for him to actually be a courageous person and not go
along. He was authentically amoral.
Yeah, yeah.
Although all this stuff, though, I mean, it jibe well with...
with Nazism?
Sure. You know, going out and talking to the noble peasants and being against discursiveness and the, you know, talk about tradition and...
There's no doubt that you could tie a lot of this stuff into the whole folk mythology and the fact that it's all about using your hands and all this practical activity is what makes the German character strong.
And the Luddite element and...
Yeah.
You know, it's a nostalgia for simpler times.
Yes, it's very...
And the anti-technology and the... I'm not saying one implies the other. I just think they do go well together.
No, you're absolutely right, Wes. And I'm not naive in my... Like, this had a profound impact on me in my intellectual development. But it wasn't like I didn't spend a couple years of my life, like, reading everything where people argued about whether or not you could find Nazism in his works and all the stuff about his biography and reading about the Holocaust. I mean, I spent a lot of time looking through all this stuff and I came to my own terms about the fact that I happened to be profoundly impacted by somebody who was a complete douchebag.
Yes.
A Nazi douchebag. But I still believe fundamentally that he was a profound thinker. That being said, it is very easy to read into this stuff a lot of very unsettling things about fatherland and, you know, the right of the German nation and the priority of the German language and all these other sorts of things, which ultimately I chalk up to the fact that he was a peasant himself. I mean, he was extremely naive. Let's take a bunch of things away from this. One, the project of the book was to uncover the meaning of being. Okay, he pointed out something that I think is significant. Yes, I think we can look back on the tradition and realize that philosophers did not spend as much time trying to uncover what was actually meant when they were using the word being and essence and these sorts of things. Secondly, he makes a good point, I think, about the fact that we are not primarily rational creatures and that that might be something significant as far as answering this question, that there's this way that we are in the world which is much more relevant for, he's trying to turn some the everyday into the philosophical. And he points out all the things that we get out of the book that are interesting and thought-provoking that spur all of this intellectual activity in the 20th century are great. But he never finished the book, suggesting that he thought the enterprise was ultimately doomed. He never talks about the human body. His concept of perception is somewhat narrow. He ultimately is extremely naive, and he does a bunch of personally reprehensible things, and then in his later life writes very, very difficult to understand texts where he's playing around with language, and he refuses at any point in time to try to meet anybody else on their terms intellectually. So he could have tried to explain what he was doing to somebody who was even sympathetic to his, you know, not necessarily hostile, but sympathetic. But he continues to use the same language and to just resolutely insist on being who he was and talking strictly about the things the way he wanted to talk about them. And if you didn't know Greek and you didn't know German and you didn't know all this stuff, you were just shit out of luck.
Thus Heidegger.
Yes. And so he's a towering and influential but troubling figure. And I still think that there are plenty of, you know, there are lots of people, especially the ones who were close to him, like his students and the people who lived through the war, who really had a hard time reconciling. And that biographical aspect of his life, I think, is also really interesting. I think it spurred a lot of activity, that there were a lot of people who were passionate about trying to reconcile themselves with him. And it produced quite a lot of good, interesting thought.
I thought it was a stunning demonstration of his naivete that he ultimately lost his entire fortune to the Nigerian prince email scam.
He prefigured email.
Yes. Few people know that Heidegger had early access to email. Yes. For me, the biographical stuff, I'm cynical enough to not worry about that, right? I mean, it's interesting, but, you know, it's sort of a genetic fallacy or an ad hominem to say, well, Heidegger was a Nazi, so fuck his philosophy. But I'm ambivalent about the whole spirit of any enterprise, which has this nostalgia for a idealized past where, let's say, you know, people were more authentic and in touch with being, and we can somehow get back to that, you know. anything that reeks of that sort of prescriptive, we got to get back to the days when things were good, and has that feel of old men sitting around around the fire talking about how in my day things were, you know, being disclosed itself.
We understood the word foosis for what it was.
Yeah, exactly. that has us. I used to be all about that, and now I'm all not about that. And so I'm just completely ambivalent about it, despite my bitterness in some ways, being sort of a formally religious person in that way, philosophically religious. I really enjoyed this reading. It was, you know, and I want to spend more time reading Heidegger. Sounds strange to say that. I don't know if anyone's ever said that. I want to spend more time reading Heidegger. But I came away, and despite being a little bit thrown off by all the wordy, you know, the same stuff with Husserl, the wordiness and the repetition and seeming to very dramatically say not such big things in this big way, I think there's something important. I mean, Seth, what you talked about, this revolution in metaphysics, let's say, and the idea of care being fundamental, it's something I want to think about a lot more.
I would say for regular people, go just read Dreyfus's book, read his commentary, which I think is what I kind of did the first time around, as opposed to reading a lot of Being in Time, because you'll get the story. Of course, there are interpretive matters, but Dreyfus dwells on those a long time too. I was really excited to do Heidegger just because it was such a gap in my knowledge. I felt like in an area that I should have been more specialized in. You know, I like phenomenology. That was one of my focuses, but yet I had just not read enough Heidegger to feel respectable about it. So I really immersed myself in him this time. And so I've had enough of him for a while, but I did get so that first of all, I don't care if it's derivative. I have no proof that it is derivative, even though that's been said to me. But from what you were just describing, Seth, you know, if somebody puts all these guys together, even if they don't add anything really fundamental themselves, I don't care. If it's new to me, don't dwell on who is historically important, whatever. Dwell on what is actually helping you understand stuff. Anyway, I did find some of the ideas that I got out of this, or out of this plus Dreyfus, to be pretty thought-provoking. And Heidegger's style, I don't know, there's something, maybe it's just kind of mystical obscurantism, but I kind of like it. And yeah. And even though I get bogged down when he takes like too long in the etymology and like just kind of move to the next point, please. And I can't bring myself just to skim to the next point. I have to keep reading the damn thing all the way through. But I don't know, there's something compelling, and I got to the point of it where I was just like with the Husserl last time, like when I was looking back, I didn't look back at much of it to take notes, but the part that I was looking back at, I was able to skim fairly easily once I'd experienced it with pain the first time. You kind of get so you can speak Heideggerian, and it's not so bad.
I'm glad to hear that.
All right, I think we gave our closing statement.
Yes.
Well, next time we are finally going to read something that's not, well, he's French, so it is continental philosophy, but he's from the 16th century, so no, it's not this kind of continental philosophy. Michel de Montaigne. We're going to read some essays by Montaigne. On Experience, On Solitude, Of Cannibals, Education of Children. To philosophize is to learn how to die, and possibly more. Go look on partiallyexaminedlife.com under general announcements to see which. You can also comment on this episode, get our past episodes, just discuss. We post ongoing things to elaborate issues that come up in here, and encourage you to get on, tell us what we have said that is wrong, tell us what more you'd like to hear about, share your experiences imbibing this entertainment education resource, and please give us some good iTunes store ratings. So good night to you.
Good night.
Good night.
They're gonna find you out. 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 You built it, they bought it, so flawed and contradictory, but they don't know the half of it. You hope they never will. It, you want it, a part of you embraces what stands out upon your face is just the tip of your nose. Though you want to clear yourself out till your feet hit the scene, you think it's much too late for that and you can never be clean. They're gonna find you out. They're gonna find you out. They're gonna find you out. done it. You went and followed through, and now it's seeping right through you, and it cannot be denied. You use it, you ooze it, your inner core will choose it, and you're never gonna lose it, cause it's gotten inside. Oh, you want to clear yourself out so you fit to be seen. You think it's much too late for that, and you can never be clean. They're gonna find you out. They're gonna find you out. They're gonna find you out. Slip and you'll die. You're in it, you're on it, this trip you've come along. Unclench your lips to hum a song and quiet each beauty cry. So you'd like to open up to someone, share it around.